This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Welcome back. It is Wednesday, and this is not Tom Hartman. It is Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom. Tom, I hope the high seas are suiting you. I hope you're having fun. Maybe sometime in the next 3 hours today, I will tell you my very own story of scaling the walls of one of those cruise ships. But that's for another moment. I'm Laura Flanders. You can call into the show, as always, at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. We've got a great program lined up for you. In this hour, we will talk a little bit about the history of sexism when it comes to media reporting on female presidential candidates. Don't know why that came up. We just thought, why the heck not? In hour two, we will talk with Ben Wisner, an ACLU attorney who is still waiting for the serious questions to be asked of all of the candidates with respect to presidential power in this period of unending supposed war. In hour three, really a very special guest lined up for us to give you a sneak peek at an upcoming book, Wrestling with the Angels of Democracy, on being an American citizen, with author, poet, essayist, playwright, screenwriter, Professor Susan Griffin. Susan will be with us here in the last hour, and I'm going to talk throughout this program, I think, about some of what I've been thinking about having perused Susan's book. Let's start with last night, and I will give open lines to you all to weigh in on last night's debate. I'm assuming a lot of you watched it. I'm assuming more than one of you probably shared my feeling of, ouch. How did we go from a presidential campaign, a primary campaign, that was generating so much excitement and so much enthusiasm to one that is now all about hostility? One where the candidates cannot win. They are either too hot and hostile or not hot and hostile enough. The media complain about both. And I would say it seems to me that one candidate can't win more than the other. And she can't win for all the wrong reasons, as far as I'm concerned. Big question to you for the hour. What about this process would you change? Is it working for you? 866-303-2270. I've got a few ideas for how to change this primary process. But first, let's talk about what is going on. How do we go from this all-engaging, massive turnout, very, enthused experience of engagement on the ground, and I followed that for the months leading up to the first few debates. I went all over the country, but most recently Colorado, Montana, around the United States, it was in Illinois, I went all over. And I found at the grassroots the kind of cool water, refreshing drink of citizens engaged in their communities, engaged with one another, being the kind of active democratic citizen that Susan Griffin writes about. That is not only democratic, and we live in a country that claims to be a democracy, but democratic in that in our personal practices, we take responsibility to act as citizens in a democracy. We act. It's not just our speeches. Just as Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence wasn't just a document, it was an expression of independence. So, too, I found on the ground in the run-up to this primary, or during the first few months of this primary, a spirit of engagement, of action. And people were feeling the kind of euphoria that comes over them when they get involved. Haven't you gotten excited when you got involved in a direct action or a protest? Susan Griffin writes about that, too. It's strangely exciting, euphoric, almost a religious experience to be on the line, standing up for what you believe in. If you were involved in the women's movement, if you were involved in the immigrant rights movement, which I think is really a workers' rights movement, if you were involved in the civil rights movement, you know what I'm talking about. If you are fighting this war now, maybe you're gearing up to participate in protests on March 19th on the anniversary. Maybe you're gearing up to protest where you live every day, every weekend. Maybe you participate in a vigil. There's something exciting about getting involved because you're taking back your power. You're realizing the promise of our society, which is that we can have a role, and you're taking the duties that come along with that seriously. That you can complain about the way things are, but unless you figure out how to either withdraw your support from the way things are or challenge the way things are in an effective way, your complaining, griping, and whining is not the behavior of a responsible citizen. So how do we go from that cool water breath and drink of engagement? And I don't even, you know, I saw a lot of it on the Barack Obama side, frankly. A little bit less of it on the Hillary side, but there was plenty of it on the Hillary side at the beginning of all this. There were a lot of women who couldn't have been prouder and more excited to be voting for a woman for president. And yes, I do think it would make a difference to have a woman in the White House. It's complicated. But it would make a difference. It wouldn't make all the difference. It would make a difference. We can talk about it. But how do we go from that level of engagement to this level of ugh? And I don't have a better word for it. All I know is I rushed home last night. I was working until about 9:15. Rushed home last night, turned on the debate, sat there and watched with my girlfriend Elizabeth, and she got increasingly furious at Barack Obama in a personal way. I got increasingly silent because I felt that all the important issues we need talking about today were not being talked about. And instead we had a 16-minute debate about a health care plan that doesn't exist, and if it did exist, wouldn't help us, as far as I can see, move closer to single-payer, non-profit health care. To me, that first 16 minutes summed up the problem. Here we have a debate about a fantasy. And maybe it's important for the candidates to distinguish one from the other, but the type of change they're talking about healthcare is not going to change our healthcare system in the way that we need to change it. I went to sit down and watch that debate with the news in my mind. And what was some of the news in my mind? Well, $4 a gallon gas around the horizon. Who's benefiting? Who's hurting? The UN is saying they're going to have to ration food aid because food has become too expensive for the poor of the world. And what do we think triggers violence more than fights over resources, food, water, and fuel? The U.S. role in the world is increasingly irrelevant. Not to say we're not doing damage, but when it comes to influencing for the good, forget it. Turkey, supposedly a close ally of ours, had no qualms, apparently, invading North Iraq and slaughtering scores of Kurds. They claim are guerrilla fighters. Well, everybody always claims that the people they're killing are guerrilla fighters. We'll know it when we see it. I won't believe it till I see the facts. The U.S. may be about to lose the only allies they ever had in Iraq, namely the Kurds. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ahmadinejad has set the date for his visit to Baghdad. It's March the 2nd. At home, for all the talk in the campaign coverage of the role of sex and gender in this debate, and nobody injected sex or gender into this debate, it is endemic, embedded in our society, in our political society, in our social society. Who's injecting race and gender? Who are they kidding? We're born injected, put it that way, and not inoculated. But for all this talk of the sex and the gender of the candidates, where is the discussion of how one's sex, an American's, a person's sex, and a person's gender, just like a lot of other characteristics, sexual orientation, age, ability, language, place you live? But let's just talk about sex and gender for a minute. We've been so busily talking about the sex and the gender of the candidates. Where is the discussion about how a person's possibility to thrive in America continues to be affected by their sex and gender? Continues. In 2008, to be affected. Our ability to thrive is different because of the way that sexism and racism and prejudice continues to play out in this country, such that if you look beneath the headlines of the subprime mortgage crisis and the foreclosure disaster and repossessions of homes, according to a report this week, are up 90% in this period over the same period last year. 90% people having their houses taken away. It was something like 46,000 people in this last period. Within the discussion of that crisis, there is almost no discussion of the reality that disproportionately it is women and people of color who receive those high-interest, high-risk loans, even when they have comparable credit ratings. That's just one example. We could talk about New Orleans, we could talk about education, we could talk about wages, we could talk about violence. Our lives are still different and affected by our race, our gender, and a whole lot of other things. None of that has come up for a discussion, even though we've had this painful, ridiculous, which side are you on, black, white, male, female, baloney discussion, standing in for the real discussion we need to have about power and prejudice and privilege in America. Why does all this hurt so bad? You tell me. 866-303-2270. The personal, has it overwhelmed the political? We could make it that case. But maybe this hurts so bad because, and my grandmother would be saying, badly, badly. Maybe it hurts because this political is personal. We all want to make a difference. We want candidates who will make a difference. We don't just want, we need change. Real change. Not the vapid, empty kind, but real change. And as this primary process continues, I think we're watching our spirit of us in this debate, the we part of this, get stripped out as we become witnesses to a boxing match that doesn't seem to have the potential to push us in a good direction. What would you do to change this process? How? Why does it feel so bad? Maybe it doesn't feel so bad to you. Give me a call, 866-303-2270. And of course, this is the Tom Hartman Show. What the heck are you going to do about it? 866-303-2270. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
As I said last week, you know, it's been an honor to campaign. I still intend to do everything I can to win, but it has been an honor because it has been a campaign that is history making. You know, obviously, I am thrilled to be running to be the first woman president, which I think would be a sea change in our country and around the world, and would give enormous, enormous hope and, you know, real challenge to the way things have been done and who gets to do them and what the rules are. So I feel that either one of us will make history.
That was Senator Hillary Clinton closing out her debate with Senator Barack Obama last night in the Democrats' 20th presidential primary debate and the last one before crucial votes in the delegate-rich states of Ohio and Texas, not to mention Rhode Island and Vermont are cast. Do you think it would make a difference? What did you think of that comment? What do you think of this primary race? I think we've all wanted it to be historic, in a good way. It's beginning to sink in that maybe it'll be historic in a bad way, and I'll just leave it at that. Let's take a call. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, welcome.
Hey, Laura, how are we doing?
Do you think it's just coincidence there are only men calling? I've got a bank of 12 calls here, all guys. I love you, but it's noteworthy, don't you think?
We're enamored with your accent. I think that's like hearing a Southern woman talk. Kind of. Anyways, listen, I call because I'm an African American, and here's an observation I made. But first of all, before I get to that, real quick, this process, I really don't have a problem with the process. also, this, I saw this tsunami, if you will, coming during the 06 election. You know, Obama saying, well, I'm bringing all these new voters to the process. I think these voters were coming anyways because people are just fed up with the way that this country is going. And they know Democrats are better when it comes to running government. Republicans just cannot run government. And people, are, like you said, have finally got off their backsides, and they're enthused now, and they're getting involved in this process. So I think,
Mike, it sounds like you read my book, Blue Grit.
I don't know. No, I didn't read your book.
Because, but I mean, I completely agree with you. I spent most of 2005 and 6 researching what I felt was happening way before the Obama campaign began. What I felt was happening was exactly that. People beginning to realize we can't leave politics to anybody else. We've got to do it ourselves. And with new tools and with some new training and with some new talent, they were doing it. And Barack Obama's folks were smart enough to tap right in.
Right, right, exactly. Now, this thing on gender and race, this is just something that I observed, and maybe you can help me out with this. You know, I noticed on, I noticed on the cable talk shows and on the Sunday morning shows, and this is a gender thing, and I'm not saying women should support Hillary because she's a woman, but I was
Thank
a little
you.
Shocked by what I was seeing. The fact that women would get on these shows and they would bash Hillary.
Yeah.
And the thing that I noticed wasn't there is I hardly ever, I don't even think I've seen one yet, African-American get on the show and go after Barack Obama.
All right, hold it right there, Mike. We don't have a lot of time, and I really want to respond to that. It's a great
okay.
question. I think you're absolutely right, and I would agree that what we've seen out there is this bizarre phenomenon where the Barack Obama campaign has given an opportunity to all kinds of recovering racists to come out and show how recovering they are. And I don't know whether that's going to amount to a hill of beans down the road, but it's been a phenomenon. And on the other side, the Clinton campaign seems to have unleashed this license to be sexist. And in the name of political difference, people are expressing the most kind of misogynist prejudice. And women have been doing it too. Now, I think that there is a phenomenon of transference going on. I think the country's uncomfortable with a woman and a person of color running to be the most powerful people in the land. But I think it's easier today to attack a woman. And I'll leave it at that. We'll pick it up after the break with our caller, with our guest, rather, Erica Falk, who's been writing about this. I think Hillary Clinton's being attacked for the wrong reasons. I'll be back after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, can I just point out that in the last several debates, I seem to get the first question all the time. And I don't mind. I'll be happy to field them, but I do find it curious. And if anybody saw Saturday Night Live, you know, maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow. I just find it kind of curious that I keep getting the first question.
That was Hillary Clinton in last night's debate. And if you think I'm playing more Clinton clips in discussion of the debate than Obama clips, that's just to balance out what happened last night after the debate was over and the broadcast discussion continued on MSNBC. I counted them. I counted them. I shouldn't say that because I don't have the count in front of me. But I would say it was 2-1 Obama to Clinton clips. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman. And some of you who know me and know my writing may be saying, what? Laura's flipped to support Hillary Clinton? What about the piece she wrote on Super Tuesday about what kind of feminism did Hillary Clinton represent? Pretty tough piece. I got a lot of flack for it. What about all the pieces she's written enthusing about the Barack Obama campaign? I stand by every one. How could Laura be concerned about the coverage of Hillary now? She's been a forthright critic of Hillary from day one back in the 1990s days. She's criticized Hillary Clinton more than most. She is one of those women who criticizes Hillary. She wrote a chapter in a book about the contenders that was very critical of Hillary. Well, I'll tell you this. Yes, on the issues, I can give you chapter and verse about why I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. But I spent years as a media critic, too. Back in the early 90s after the, I want to call it the Anita Hill hearing, because that's how it felt. It was as if Anita Hill was on trial. She was not. But in the wake of the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, I helped with the Media Watch Group Fair to start a women's desk that looked at sexism in news reporting. A lot of feminists had looked at sexism in the culture and sexist imagery of females, et cetera, et cetera. But very little attention had been given to how sexism, putting women second or putting women in certain roles, marginalizing the attention given to women, skewing it in certain ways, how that those practices all affected our understanding of the news. And I wrote about that for years. Now, this election comes around. I wasn't writing about that. I was writing about the growth of grassroots movements. That's what I've been excited about over the last few years since I researched the book Blue Grit. And I realized, you know, it's not that there are too few Democrats out there, too few progressives, too few leftists. It's that the only representation we have of those points of view are too feeble. So I've been writing about that, and I was excited about the Obama campaign's grassroots organizing, and I still am. But I have to say, I have been nagged. There's been a nagging voice in the back of my head saying, Laura, you have to look at this media coverage. There is one thing to critique the policy, but this kind of pathetic, knee-jerk, personalized attack deserves some serious attention. And not because you defend Hillary Clinton's positions, but you want to have a political debate that is higher and better than this. So that's why I'm talking about this today, because we need to air some of this stuff. Why? Because the sexism is hurting our ability to have a real conversation in the same way that the racism is. The people are pretending as if language like whining can be used against a woman in the same way that it can be used against a man, in the same way that they're arguing that nobody should be upset about a picture of Barack Obama in a turban. It wouldn't be any different from George W. Bush in Indian garb. It is different, and we know better, and we're in denial if we think otherwise. We can't pretend this language in this culture we live in isn't loaded. And all this discussion about injecting race and gender, it's got to stop. Instead, we've got to wrestle, perhaps, with the continuing practices and legacies of discrimination that do us all in. And if we're not careful, if we don't grapple with this stuff, we the people, particularly we on the Democratic, progressive, left side of the spectrum, and those might be all different categories, if we don't grapple with this in this election, this is exactly the soft belly spot that the right are going to target all of their attacks. If you thought that the 2004 assault on John Kerry as a girly man was anything important, was anything disturbing, you wait till you see what this election's going to look like. If we try to pretend that we're all down with intersectionality and understand the implications of race and gender in our society right now, and we don't do better, smarter thinking than this, we are screwed come November. And to add insult to injury or add some information, Ward Connolly, the guy that brought you the end of affirmative action in California and has been trying his best to pass similar misleadingly titled so-called civil rights initiatives that actually destroy and ban the kind of practices that have brought us a Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton presidential candidacy, namely affirmative action. He's been trying to pass these things. He's had success in Washington State and Michigan, challenging entry policies at public universities. He has five anti-affirmative action initiatives pending in five critical, three of them battleground states in this election. This could be the gay marriage mobilizer for the right of 2008. So we have got to get our heads around this stuff. So very quickly, let's bring on a guest, Erica Falk. Erica Falk is Associate Program Chair for the Master's Degree in Communications at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Women for President, Media Bias in 8 Campaigns. She studied the historical practice of all this. And she has a cover story in the current issue of In These Times, a great lefty periodical that comes out of Chicago. And I mean lefty in all the best possible senses. She's got the cover story in the March issue. Erica, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
So the reason I wanted to bring you on was because your research shows that there is a historical context in which this presidential race is taking place, because otherwise it's become so personally about Hillary Clinton. Is it possible to distinguish the practices that are particular to Hillary and those that we need to be very aware are kind of historical?
Right. I mean, if you look at any singular race, you can always point to things about the candidate or things about the historical context that makes it unique. But what I did is I looked at 8 different races where women ran for president and compared the coverage of women to the most equivalent man running in the same race. And the results were striking. For example, if you compare men and women who poll about the same, men get twice as many articles written about them as do the women, and the articles are 7% longer.
Now,
and again, that's not comparing winning men to losing women. That's men and women who polled about the same.
Now, has that been true of Hillary Clinton, or hasn't she got the benefit of having got more attention than most women running for office?
Right. Well, she certainly got more attention than women who have polled worse than her. But I did a pilot study in January of 2007, and I compared the coverage of Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. And in the top 6 circulating newspapers that ran stories in January of 2007, which was the month in which both of them announced their candidacy, 59 stories headlined with Obama and just 36 with Clinton. And it's important to remember, in January of 2007, Clinton was leading Obama in the polls by 30% to 22%, and he still got substantially more coverage than she did.
Now, could you say, well, that's just because he's the newcomer on the block?
You certainly could, and that's what I'm saying. You can look at any single race and say, but if you look at that in historical context, you know, there are 7 races that precede it. In every one of them, the man candidate got more coverage than the equivalent woman. And at that point, you have to pause and say, maybe there's a trend going on here.
Now, there's the quantity of coverage. What about the quality? Any themes, any trends?
Yes, lots of interesting trends. One of the most distinct is this idea that women get less substantive coverage. And the way I measured that was looking at how much their issues were covered in the press. If you look at a typical article about a man candidate, about 27% of the paragraphs are about issues. But for a typical woman candidate who's run for president, just 16% of the paragraphs are about issues. So not only is the press covering women overall much less, but when they do cover women, they give the women less serious coverage.
And what about the question that I raised earlier, which had to do with, you know, we talk about the sex and gender of the candidates, but that conversation substitutes for, seems to take the place of any actual conversation about the role that a person's sex and a person's gender continue to play in our ability to thrive in America.
Well, one of the interesting things that comes out of the press coverage of women candidates, and I honestly haven't seen that much of that for Hillary Clinton, so it will be interesting when I can do a comprehensive study, but a lot of the women who have run before her get kinds of questions that men candidates don't get. So, for example, as a woman candidate, how would you? Or, because you are a woman, would you be willing to press the button? So they're asked questions, quote, as women. But we don't ever ask men candidates how their masculinity affects them. We don't say, well, because you are a man, would you have the restraint not to press the button?
Now, there was a big discussion last night after the debate, which I know you didn't see all of it, but at the end of the debate, Hillary Clinton made a comment that both campaigns were historic, that she was proud to be running to be the first woman president, and those two words together, I think, hung in the air powerfully. And she said, you know, that in itself would be a sea change in who people imagine can be the decision maker in America, how the rules work, et cetera, et cetera. In the discussion afterwards, Chris Matthews, whose record of misogyny is clear, made some quip about how you could never have said that about an African American without there being tremendous controversy, even as he was stirring up the kind of, controversy about what Hillary had said. But what do you think? Do you think it's a quid pro quo? And how useful is this quid pro quo comparison conversation? You know, can Hillary say something that Barack Obama can't? Can Barack Obama say something that Hillary can't? How helpful is this?
You know, I'm not sure because most of my research hasn't looked at race, and I would bet it plays out for race very much the same way it plays out for women. But I will say this, one of the interesting things about women running for president, it's stems from this lack of coverage, which is that we have this lost history. If you look at press coverage of Hillary Clinton, you will find it rife with the idea that she is going to be the first serious, you know, woman presidential candidate. But what's fascinating about that is that the same thing was said of Elizabeth Dole. And you can find the exact same quotations that said Elizabeth Dole was the first really serious. You can go back to 1964 when Margaret Chase Smith ran. She was the first serious woman candidate. So we have this kind of amnesia about women's long and deep political history. Lots of women have run for president. Over 8, maybe close to 12 have even gotten substantial press coverage. And yet somehow, because women are considered out of place in the political sphere, we're always the first, we're always new, we're always unnatural. And I think this kind of discourse is probably not beneficial to women candidates.
But isn't that exactly, I mean, I would urge you please to look at race, because it must be very, very much the same. And I would say at this point, if you want to see how sexism and racism really operate in America, look at the coverage of Michelle Obama, mm-hmm. where all the gloves are off. You may dislike the misogyny in the coverage of Hillary. You may, as some callers have said, say that things can be said about Hillary that could never be said about a man, that things could be said about Hillary that could never be said about Barack Obama. But anything, it seems to me, can be said about Michelle Obama up to and including what Bill O'Reilly did this week, which was essentially to say that it would be okay to go on a lynch party against Michelle Obama if she really said it. What he thinks she said, which is this is the first time she's proud of America.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. In this pilot study I did of Obama and Clinton, there was one way in which race and gender were very similar. If you look at the text about women candidates, this idea that they are a woman candidate, you know, that we're going to call out, we're going to highlight the gender of the candidate is very prominent. Well, the same thing was happening with Barack Obama. In every article, they mentioned this was a black candidate. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It was very, very prominent. So in that sense, I know that gender and race were treated very, very similarly. Mm.
What do we look for as we go into these last stages, Erica? And is it hopeless? I mean, I feel as if my effort to distinguish my complaint about the media coverage from my very long list of complaints about Hillary Clinton's political record, it just gets lost every time I try to make it.
Right. Two things I would say to look for that historical trends show is that women are described physically more often than men, and I suspect this will be true for Hillary Clinton. Their attire, what they wear, their makeup, their hair.
And can I just add, the reason that's problematic is we should be talking about her role with respect to NAFTA. We should be talking
right.
about, instead, her role supporting the bombing of Yugoslavia, her vote for the war in Iraq. If she cares about women, what about the women of Iraq and Afghanistan? My complaint is that stuff takes up the space that important conversation needs to be happening.
Absolutely. What they're not doing is covering issues about women candidates, but they're spending a lot of time talking about her hair and her makeup and her attire. The other thing the press has done in the past is diminish the accomplishments of women. And one of the ways they've done that is by dropping their titles. So, for example, instead of referring to Senator Hillary Clinton as such, they refer to her as Mrs. Clinton. And in fact, if you look at the Obama-Clinton race, again, in January of 2007, the press was more likely to drop Clinton's title than it was to drop Obama's.
Mm-hmm.
But to speak to your other point about optimism, you know...
Oh, that's what it was. I forgot.
the studies are really clear that press bias exists. But there, in my opinion, there is something even more important than press bias, which is that women don't put themselves forward as candidates. And until women start putting themselves forward as candidates to run, we're going to continue to have this kind of bias. So my optimism comes from the idea that in the next generation, hopefully more and more women will run. And as more and more women run, hopefully their treatment in the press will be easy.
Well, that takes really, I mean, that is such a job of optimism, because I'm sitting here looking at this saying, oh my goodness, if any young woman was ever thinking of running for president, would she ever do it, given this treatment of this character that she's seeing in front of her? But I will go with your optimism, because that's where my will takes me. Thank you so much, Erica.
My pleasure.
Erica Falk's story, Cutting Women Out, is on the cover of the March 08 issue of In These Times. You can find it online at inthesetimes.com. We'll be back after the break. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
The Tom Hartman Program. program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanda sitting in for Tom. We will get to more of your calls in the next hour, in the hour after that. In the next hour, we'll talk to Ben Wisner with the ACLU about what hasn't been raised in the presidential primary debate so far about, well, how about presidential authority to determine who's an enemy combatant and can be held indefinitely someplace out of reach of law? Where do the candidates stand on questions like that? Ben will be with us in the next hour. In our last hour, Susan Griffin, author of a book that's been on my mind a lot today, Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy. It's tough to live in a democracy. For all the flaws of ours, it aspires to such. It's tough because it requires actions and responsibility on the part of the citizenry. And sometimes the climate for that participation is so sour, so nasty, and so seemingly irrelevant to our lives that it's hard to get off our butts and get active, get hopeful, have any kind of belief in the possibility of change. You may be joking about the vapidity of the slogan, but the fact that people are taking it seriously enough to get off their butts is good as far as I'm concerned. Listen, it's interesting, our last guest said she hadn't considered race in her analysis of media coverage of presidential campaigns and candidates. We've never had a race like this before, an African-American and a woman in the top places. The fact is they're both politicians. They're both going to go negative. They're both going to be listening first to corporate interests, listening second to we the people. We the people have a job right now. If we don't want to see John McCain swim to the presidency, float to the White House on a sea of venom against people of color and women, if we don't want to see a backlash like we have never seen from the white male liberal everything else, complaining that it was women and people of color who ruined this race, we have got to figure out how to spend the next few months talking to people who are terrified about voting for an African American, or maybe if something else happens, terrified about voting for a woman, or refusing to, or angry about it, or scared, or whatever. We've got to figure out how to talk about this stuff. And the media are not helping. We'll take your calls. I'll take your calls right after the break. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, Tom is on the cruise for the rest of us, at least for the rest of us Air America people. Tom Hartman's not here today. I am. I'm Laura Flanders. You can hear me on Radio Nation weekends here on Air America Radio. You can check out my website at lauraflanders.com, I think it is. And you might be able to email me. You just might be able to email me. You could try emailing me at flanders.laura@gmail.com. Try it. flanders.laura@gmail.com. We've had all kind of bouncing problems with every other website, but try that one if you're so inclined. The number to call is 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. We're taking your calls on what about this primary process would you change, and why does it feel so bad, if it feels bad to you. Here's some of the news that I think we could be thinking about, talking about, maybe, seems important to me. A U.S. service member in California has admitted to deliberately getting himself shot to avoid service in Iraq. Police say the unarmed 20-year-old soldier from San Bernardino County had a friend shoot him in the leg in a faked robbery. Under questioning, he finally admitted to staging the shooting so he could avoid returning to Iraq for a second deployment. Now, I'm getting that from the local papers, but boy, we have some serious issues to be discussing, and issues that relate to the decisions whoever is elected president this November will have to be making come January and next year. Among the decisions that we're going to talk about in this hour are decisions over the issue of what to do about the degree, the amount of executive authority George W. Bush has sequestered to himself, gathered to his presidency. How much of those, how many of those presidential powers, sort of new presidential powers, some of them legislatively achieved through the USA Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, some of them achieved through interpretation of the law. You've all heard about the unitary executive theory of the Bush administration's legal team. Some of them kind of de facto through the president's use of signing statements. He's decided he has the, you know, constitutional right to simply bypass more than 1,000 sections of bills he doesn't like. Bills he's signed into law that our Congress has passed. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have criticized the president's use of these signing statements, but both have also said, in response to a questionnaire from the Boston Globe, that they would continue using signing statements. Is that okay with you? There are other questions about the president's ill-gotten power to detain citizens without charges as enemy combatants. Is that something a new president will maintain? The courts say that, the courts have upheld, two different courts have upheld the indefinite detention, but other courts have challenged it. Would you use court-approved authority to hold citizens indefinitely as enemy combatants? Is it okay with you if the courts say it's okay? These and other questions are the kind of questions we'll talk about in this hour in just a bit with our guest Ben Wisner when he joins us at the bottom of the hour. He's an ACLU attorney. You know, they've gotten away very cheaply, I'd say, with saying that they're both going to close Guantanamo. That's just the beginning. It's these presidential powers we need some answers on. All right, let's take some calls. What would you change about the primary process if you would change something? I would change something. I would change the structure so that it doesn't go on for so long and it doesn't involve flying over quite so many states and belching quite so many, harmful gases into the atmosphere. Those two candidates looked so worn out last night that I can't believe we expect them to make any sense. How about regional primaries? That's my proposal. How about four regional primaries? Take 4 months, 5 months, 6 months if you want. Have four regional primaries, national mandatory media coverage of not just of the debates, but of some of the speeches, or maybe all the speeches, have them available for us to watch. Let's not just have these debates be the proprietary possessions of different networks so that only certain people with cable can watch these ones and that ones. This is part of our democracy. We need publicly financed elections. And I've got a list of other things, too. It just seems ridiculous to me. They're all pledging to do something about global warming, and they're all burning up so much fossil fuel, flying from place to place, that nothing they could do in terms of policy will repair what they've done in terms of running for office. Let's take a call. Let's hear from Carol in Mountain View. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Hi, Laura. It's really nice to talk to you. You said some of the things that I wanted to say about the questions that could be asked. I mean, there is a whole long list of things that we want to know. We want to know about nuclear non-proliferation. I was going to mention executive power.
Nuclear non-proliferation, that question, that subject, the words haven't been said since Dennis Kucinich was forced out.
And we want to know about Social Security and Medicare, and we want to know, but we have two people asking questions. Tim Russert is a gotcha guy. He likes to say, and he does this on Meet the Press, he likes to say, you said this then, now you're saying something else. And Brian Williams, did you hear the question that he asked at the end? What would your opponent have to do to win the nomination?
No, he said to say, what would he have to do? What question would he have to answer or she have to answer to show that she was worthy?
Yeah.
You schmuck.
Oh, that was it. To show. Well, you know, if we had somebody like Bill Moyers asking questions, we would learn something about the candidates, and it would make some sense.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is supposed to be, you know, electing an American president, not an exercise in American Idol.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be about gotcha, gotcha. And you could see them. The two, I think it was two debates ago, I think it was John King saying, well, you seem to be getting along very well now, but you were really fighting earlier, and let's see if we can stir up some of the debate.
Yes.
And it's
that kind of thing that goes on, and it, I don't feel that it's the fault of the candidates. They are really under wraps, kind of, by the people who are questioning them in the setup of the debate.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting yesterday. I mean, it all becomes so psychological, but in those first 16 minutes, I had so many complicated feelings. One was, or thoughts. They weren't so much feelings as thoughts, and there is a difference. But,
yeah.
You know, one was, I think it's good. They're taking control of this discussion. They're not allowing themselves to be railroaded. They're having an in-depth discussion about their differences on this question of policy.
Yeah.
And then my sane voice took over and said, but the policy they're discussing sucks, you know, and the differences between them are so small, and this isn't going to solve our healthcare crisis. So I'm glad that they have sort of seized the steering wheel for a moment of the debate, but the subject matter is wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, there is another thing about the sexism. The media is in full control. They acted like John Edwards didn't even exist. And it was as if the media had decided on the two people who were going to be the finalists, and the other people were insignificant.
I wonder, what do you think, Carol? Do you think, and this is, again, I mean, I was hoping in my you know, delusional self, I thought in 2008 we had gone beyond just bean counting, which is to say, you know, there was an idea in the 70s and 80s that thanks to the laws that were passed and the policies that were changed, we would have a media sooner or later, like the rest of our professional world, that would look somewhat like America.
Yes.
And even if it was tokenism, we would at least have learned that you can't, that you need to represent diversity. Looking at these discussions where you have an African-American and a woman,
mm-hmm.
and the questioners are all white men, takes me right back to about 1971, calling for, give me tokens, even just tokens, give me tokens.
Yeah, it's pretty true. Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's not only are they trained in that kind of gotcha, amp up the ratings style of political debate and discourse,
yeah.
and it's all about keeping the viewers watching through the commercials. That's the whole trick of commercial media. But they are also, you know, they've no idea what they're talking about on some of these issues that these candidates, both of them, are trying to address, which is why I think Hillary Clinton gets away with kind of, you know, rather sad, cheap shot efforts to rally female support behind her, and how, you know, Barack Obama gets away with kind of distancing himself from the civil rights community and the African-American community. There are a lot of African-Americans who are furious about how he both wants to be to embody the legacy of King without embracing the movements of King, really.
Well, there's an aura of I got to protect myself, and with the press, it's I got to see if I can catch him at something. It doesn't make sense. It's not a debate. I wanted somebody to ask them, would you order your people not to testify at an investigation in Congress?
Yeah.
And some of the other questions that you brought up.
So, I mean, in an ideal scenario, you would have a moderator who looked at the key contentious questions of the last 8 years.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about the 8 years before that, then fine. I think, you know, NAFTA is fair game. I think immigration policy is fair game. But trade and immigration policy need to be linked, not discussed as completely separate and distinct phenomena. Why are people migrating? Because there are no jobs where they live. Why are there no jobs where they live? Because our trade policy has wiped out their farms.
Yes, but can you explain it in 30 or 60 or 90 seconds?
I think I just did.
Yeah. Well, Laura, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol. I appreciate it. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. More of your calls. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Who would be worthy of the night? I think I'd be better. Otherwise, I wouldn't be running. But there's no doubt that Senator Clinton is qualified and capable and would be a much better president than John McCain, who I respect and I honor his service to this country, but essentially has tethered himself to the failed policies of George Bush over the last 7 years. On economics, he wants to continue tax cuts to the wealthy that we can't afford. And on foreign policy, he wants to continue a war that not only can we not afford in terms of money, but we can't afford in terms of lives. And it's not making us more safe. We can't afford it in terms of strategy.
That was Senator Barack Obama, I think, making a fairly reasonable and smart and stylish response to the ridiculous question posed by Brian Williams in last night's MSNBC debate, in which Williams asked both the candidates, starting with Obama, what question would their competitor have to answer to prove worthy of receiving the nomination? And Barack Obama began by saying, this is, you know, not a question of worthiness. 866-303-2270. Now, other people watched that clip and said he was condescending and cocky and disdainful. You know, people see different things. 866-303-2270. In our next segment, we will be talking with Ben Wisner from the ACLU about some of the questions having to do with presidential executive powers and what the current candidates have and haven't been asked about those powers and what they intend to do with them. And in our last hour, Susan Griffin will be here with a wonderful new book about wrestling with the angels of democracy, a really fabulous personal political discourse. Naomi's on the line in San Diego. A lot of women started calling in. Naomi, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thank you very much, Laura, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed listening to you and Carol talk. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole bunch I'd like to say. And now we don't have really much to say because people get too busy in America. They're either working two jobs because they can't afford to live anymore. And
that's a good way of putting it.
They drop out of being active because they're too busy. Well, I find time wherever I'm at. I will make sure that I get it out. And when people listen to rhetoric, that's what really drives me crazy. I tell them, why don't you do the research yourself? Find out what Hillary said. Find out what Hillary voted for. Don't listen to your friend who listens to the media, because the media has so far gone now that you have to do your own research.
Yeah, I mean, there is a big glitch in democracy when the people who we rely on to do the voting don't have time to acquire the information, and the information that is readily available doesn't even deserve the word, doesn't
exactly.
even deserve the description of information. It's propaganda.
Exactly. And so I, over the years, I've been with my husband for 18 years now, and he is very political minded, and he listens and he does research, and so I have learned to do that. And then also, like Carol and you were talking about, the questions that are being asked. And the reason that those questions are being asked is because we as Americans are not standing up and saying, look, you need to ask the questions that we're interested in. And because not enough of us, everybody seems to think that one vote doesn't count. Well, guess what? I'll have three votes in my house because my husband will vote. I will go out and vote. And I am teaching my 15-year-old daughter, you need to get out and vote the minute you turn 18. So we can triple our votes just within one home.
And sometimes I think that the media is doing their best to turn us all off this process. And if we watched the national coverage less and went to more local meetings, we might be more inspired.
Absolutely. I absolutely.
Now, we could also be less inspired given the nature of some local meetings, but you get my point.
Yeah, but it starts within your home.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, you know, I've waited a few hours, but I really want to get it out to these women that they have a voice. They have to teach their children. They have to say, look, how much has insurance cost us in the past 10 years? It's gone from $300 a month for the family to almost $700, and our insurance coverage has gotten less. We pay more, we get less coverage.
I think you're absolutely right, Naomi. The answer to the kind of low level of discourse at the national level and in the media is to have a much higher level of discourse where we live. And that can begin with exactly what you're suggesting. Ask people about their lives. How are they getting by? Are they getting by? And then you can talk about what options might be out there. And if we all decide there aren't enough good options out there, maybe we'll make up something new. 866-303-2270. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Thanks for your call. We'll take more after this.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Well, you heard the debate. What was in it? What was not? Let's talk about what was not. So we had an interesting guest on last week's Radio Nation program. I host Radio Nation here on Air America Radio weekends, also heard on non-commercial stations around the country during the week. So maybe you're hearing it on some of your other stations this week. One of our guests was Ben Wisner. He's an ACLU attorney who has litigated numerous post-9/11 civil liberties cases, including challenges to the CIA's rendition and torture program. He's also been to Guantanamo several times to monitor military commissions in action. Or not in action. He'll be going there again in March. I invited him to participate in this program, too, because he had so many important things to say when we talked last week about the questions that the candidates should be being asked. And as far as I can hear, they're still not being asked, not even after 20 debates having to do with presidential power. Ben Wisner, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
I'm glad to be back, Laura. Thanks for having me again.
So 20 debates.
Well, I sure haven't watched 20 debates.
I have listened to a lot of them, and I have watched most of them.
Well, you get paid to watch them. I don't.
Well, that's not enough. Not enough. It's dirty work. Someone's got to do it. The issues you're raising are which? What do you think are the important things? They're all going along saying, you know, I'll make sure Guantanamo is closed. But you say the subject doesn't stop there.
Well, I don't know. I didn't hear anything about Guantanamo last night. Maybe,
no, there
maybe
wasn't.
It's because I kept turning the channel to watch the New York Philharmonic in Pyongyang, which was a lot more interesting. But you say it wasn't mentioned.
No, it wasn't mentioned last night.
It's actually striking how absent in general civil liberties concerns have been from the debates in both parties. You've heard a little bit more of it on the Republican side with some of their candidates wanting to double Guantanamo and dunk people's heads in the water. You know, I will say this, that on one issue at least, and that's the issue of torture, it seems that the remaining candidates in the race at this stage of the primary process, you know, will at the very least erase that one shame from our country. I don't expect that come 2009 we'll be talking about whether people in the custody of our government are being drowned, frozen, shocked, and beaten into revealing what information they may or may not have.
Well, I hope I believe you, but we do know that the special, whatever it is called, extraordinary rendition practice, unfortunately, didn't begin under Bush. It began under Clinton.
Right, and it has changed. I should say that attending to my last comment, that the fact that we're even discussing torture as an issue in a U.S. presidential campaign shows how degraded legally and morally we've become under this administration. We shouldn't have to talk about whether there's going to be torture, but you do. I mean, you make an important point. The question of civil liberties did not arise under the Bush and Cheney administration, and these issues will not, unfortunately, go away no matter who is elected. Even if we don't continue to subject people to brutal torture in our own custody, something like closing down Guantanamo does not become a simple thing just because a new President Clinton or President Obama takes over the White House.
One of the subjects that came up yesterday was the subject of taking military action, U.S. military unilateral action against, and the subject that came up was a supposed Al-Qaeda target, say, in Pakistan or in the border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the two candidates were asked, I think specifically Barack Obama was asked to clarify what he had said on this subject in a previous debate. And essentially it comes down to, would you or would you not, you know, have the chutzpah to take action and take someone out? And it came out again, it came up again with respect to Iraq. If the I can't remember quite. Oh, I think it was. No, it had to do with Serbia. The question was raised, I think, by Tim Russert, if the new Russian president, Medvedev, and it was a pity Hillary Clinton couldn't pronounce his name, Medvedev, acted in such a way as to stir up Serbian nationalism once again in Yugoslavia, maybe trying to take back that part of Kosovo, recently declared itself independent, that the Serbs think is theirs. Would you take action? And it was so indicative of where our debate has gone that neither candidate said, actually we would have to go to Congress for approval to take military action. And neither candidate said actually there's international law against government assassination. I mean, all this stuff is so far fallen by the wayside. And maybe it fell victim to 9/11, but I think it was keeling over earlier. That we've got a long way to go before we have some of the kinds of conversations that you're saying are so urgent.
It's interesting. I was just yesterday looking at a document that the ACLU had prepared back in 1991 to give to the transition team of whoever the winning candidate was. And one of the issues that was raised right then was that, as you say, war powers are allocated in the Constitution to Congress, and there's been a sort of steady deterioration in that principle that it's Congress that decides, you know, when and where the military should act abroad. And it is distressing to see that, at least with respect to that issue, it doesn't seem to be on anybody's plate right now.
To the reverse. I mean, the candidates basically had to grandstand on how willing they would be to take unilateral action as president. And this was an indicative, you know, indication of how fit they would be, or maybe Brian Williams would say how worthy they would be, to be the commander-in-chief. Not right. One. I mean, I just wanted one of them to say, Congress has the authority.
Right. Well, and I want to make a couple more points
about
civil liberties. I mean, the first is that the absence of these issues from the debate is really important, and it's really consequential. Because if whoever the next president is elected without having to talk about these issues in the campaign, that person will not believe or be able to say that civil liberties is part of the person's mandate. It may be that the parties would prefer to run for president without committing themselves publicly to the restoration of civil liberties, but that will have real consequences because it will be harder for us in 2009 to say, you told us you were going to do this, we voted for you for that reason. Second, something like Guantanamo, the Bush and Cheney administration's torture regime, is not easy to expunge. It becomes a kind of cancer or even a gangrene in the legal system. Cheney and Bush made a disastrous decision to take captured terrorism suspects not into our federal courts but into secret prisons where they were subjected to brutal torture. As a result of that, it may now be difficult to do what should have been done then, which is bring all of these people into civilian federal court and prosecute them and punish them if indeed they were responsible for 9/11. And so what had been a very bogus argument, which is that we need a new system of detention and prosecution, by virtue of the fact that these men have now been tortured, now has a different kind of validity because it may be now too late to do what we should have done then.
Mm. We were talking when we spoke last, you and I, Ben, about a story in the Nation magazine apropos of came out of an interview conducted by a documentary filmmaker, Ross Tuttle, with one of those men who has been responsible for, he was at one point chief prosecutor of Guantanamo's military commissions, Colonel Morris Davis. Morris Davis charged that the Pentagon's chief legal officer and overseer of Guantanamo had said that the administration would never accept any kind of acquittal in the Guantanamo cases. This is complicated to follow, but Davis claimed that Haynes, in a conversation, had said, we can't have acquittals, we have to have convictions. If we've been holding these people for so long, how can we explain letting them get off? Now, that was huge for Colonel Davis to go public with what Haynes had said. There was more news yesterday that William Haynes, the man who, as I said, was put by the administration as the overseer of Guantanamo's military commissions, has resigned.
Is he going to spend more time with his family?
That's what he said.
Yeah, it's interesting. This must be what it felt like, reading the news in the Soviet Union in 1982 or something. You know, you read about a resignation from the administration, and you just have to engage in a game of speculation. What might this be about? We have no idea, and certainly the words that they offer are a distortion, not an explanation. But I do think that the point you raise is an important one. This was not a dispute between the ACLU and William Haynes. This was a dispute between a decorated Air Force colonel and a civilian in the Pentagon. There are many people in the United States military, perhaps a majority, at least those who are lawyers, who are appalled at what's gone on at Guantanamo with the military commission system, with CIA black sites, with so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. Those men and women will be very grateful to the next commander-in-chief for beginning the effort to restore the honor and integrity of the armed forces. And it may well be that the article in The Nation that we were talking about over the weekend was the final straw that allowed the Secretary of Defense, Gates, to get rid of this Rumsfeld holdover Haynes. But I'm just guessing.
When you say there are very real implications, you know, the real implications at this point of the presidential campaign are all being measured in terms of their impact on the presidential candidates. Take us back for just a moment before we have to let you go to the people who are being detained, the people who have been subject to the kind of interrogation we're talking about. Just remind us of the other people in this picture. It's not just politics. There are people here. Ben Wiesner is an ACLU attorney, and I said that he'd been involved in many post-9/11 civil liberties cases. He has been to Guantanamo. Tell us a story. Tell us about someone.
Well, I represent a German citizen named Khaled El-Masri, who, in a case of mistaken identity, he was the wrong Khaled El-Masri, was snatched off the streets in Macedonia, locked in a hotel at gunpoint for 3 weeks, handed to the CIA, had his clothing cut off of him with knives, had a suppository forced into his anus, was chained to the floor of a CIA plane, was flown to Afghanistan, a country where he had never set foot, and imprisoned in a dungeon for 5 months, long after the United States government realized that it had detained the wrong person. Rather than apologize to him and compensate him, he was flown back to Europe and dropped on a hilltop in Albania at night. Now, this is not an action that's worthy of our government. Listen, I have other clients who are subjected to much, much worse torture than Khaled El-Masri and who have not yet been released from custody. But it occurs to me that there are, you know, two kinds of people in looking at this debate. There are those who think that the people who are locked at Guantanamo are the greatest threat to U.S. security. And there are those of us who believe that Guantanamo is a greater threat to U.S. security than the people who are locked up there, no matter what they may have done or might be planning to do.
The subject, the question remains, where is this in our national discourse about the future, our future under whoever is the next president? I appreciate you consistently raising these questions, Ben, and I'm hoping that we can follow on up on this story over the next few weeks and maybe force it yet into the discussion. I appreciate your work.
Thanks, Laura. Let's try.
Will do. If people want more information about Ben's work and the work of the ACLU, well, you know where to go, www.aclu.org, www.AmericanCivilLibertiesUnion, that's ACLU.org. Let's try to push this, shall we? All right, we'll be back with more of your calls after the break. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Flanders, and I'm sitting in for Tom Hartman. Like it or not, 866-303-2270. We'll take more of your calls after the break, but right now we have Ellen Ratner with us on the line for the news from D.C. Ellen, welcome to the program. Welcome to your usual
spot. Thank you,
Laura.
I was at the Ohio debate last night, and it was very interesting. I mean, we all saw parts of it or all of it or whatever. But when I went into the crowd, and these were mainly Ohioans, it didn't matter whether they were for Obama or whether they were for Hillary Clinton or undecided, they all felt that Tim Russert was too sort of tough Sunday show and didn't really get enough into the issues. He was too interested in sort of getting them on any flip-flop.
I agree. I mean, it was gotcha, gotcha, gotcha. And I wouldn't mind if they were playing gotcha about the serious stuff, but I didn't feel that was happening. I mean, he was egging them on to be more aggressive as commander-in-chief. He was egging them on to make pledges around NAFTA that had no bearing on reality. What sort of things did people want him to be asking?
Well, I think they really wanted a very full discussion on the economy. They really wanted a more in-depth about how they were going to create jobs. I think that they wanted more in-depth about foreign policy. And I think they felt like they just got a taste because he was too involved in saying, well, you know, are you going to release your tax returns and that kind of thing?
Now, on the tax returns, Hillary Clinton is getting her supporters are getting a wake up this morning in the sense that, having said she's going to release as soon as possible, she's not. Not until tax day.
Absolutely. By the way, just on the campaign thing before I go into the Senate and that kind of thing,
yep.
Byron Dorgan has, of North Dakota has now endorsed Obama, and also Tom Daschle today got on a conference with Ohio farmers and obviously with press people to talk about Ohio farms and what Obama was going to do for that.
Now, so Daschle's been
really
a supporter
of the rural vote in Ohio.
Daschle's been a supporter of Obama's for a long time.
Absolutely, but Byron Dorgan is brand new to this. Ben Bernanke talked about the Fed today. He said, surprise, surprise, he sees a sluggish economy.
How much are we paying him?
A lot of money.
All right.
He said that he's going to keep a close eye on inflation. He will they will act on inflation in a timely manner, and he said he's going to assess the overall monetary policy, and we'll be calibrating it. That's a lot of saying absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Now, when he says he will act, you know, at what point does $4 a gallon gas demand action? And what is there going to be done about the fact that our entire economy, it seems to me, is resting on Americans borrowing and other people spending the almost worthless American dollar?
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting, actually, Harry Reid today and Debbie Stabenow had an event where they talked about predatory lending, but they also talked about the subprime mortgage crisis and that African-American families were disproportionately involved in this.
And
they
women.
Want to deal with this in some way. And Reid also said that he wants to push forth a Senate housing bill to purchase and rehab homes that have been foreclosed, and to try and help people get into these homes so that they can actually have a place to go, and they're not going to have entire communities of homes that are just been foreclosed on and then all kinds of other people move in that aren't supposed to be there.
Quick, before we have to let you go, Ellen, is there any more development in the Senate vote to begin debate on that measure that would withdraw troops from Iraq, the Feingold Initiative?
I haven't seen the votes come down quite yet, but I think they're going to be coming down later. There's actually, Reid also announced in relation to that they're going to have many hearings on Iraq. They actually had one today on the use of private security firms. That was actually run by Joe Lieberman, and we'll get into that in a second. They're going to be doing something on Pakistan. Interestingly enough, General Zinni, very much a critic of the administration, is going to be speaking in the next week or two on March 11th, a hearing on waste, fraud, and abuse. And by the way, before I get into the Lieberman hearing, Mr. Mukasey is touring Gitmo today.
Interesting. You got 30 seconds. Tell us about Lieberman.
Okay, basically, Lieberman said that there was a role in security of Americans overseas, that they had done a pretty good job, but there have been problems. He said they need to do training standards and pay attention to international human rights laws. Again, very, very broad.
Very, very baloney. Ellen, thank you so much. Talk Radio News is Ellen Ratner. We'll be back with more after the break, and we'll take your calls. Yes, I think Hillary Clinton has run an awful, god-awful campaign. She made bad decisions that brought her to this place. But that still doesn't justify some of the treatment. No reason to vote for her, though. 866-303-2270. I'm Laura Flanders.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman here on Air America Radio. It's been great being with you the last couple of hours. We've got one great hour still to go. Susan Griffin will be joining us in this hour to give us a sneak peek of her new book. Her new book is titled Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy on Being an American Citizen. And her contention is, it ain't easy. 866-303-2270. Deborah wrote in to correct the record. Apparently, Byron Dorgan endorsed Obama way back during the Iowa campaign. It's not new. Ellen Ratner reported that Dorgan was talking to Ohioans about the merits of Barack Obama's campaign, and maybe she said that he endorsed him. And this was news. He endorsed him, apparently, weeks ago. I'll go back and check that. But thanks for that, Deborah. A lot of people are writing in saying that Hillary Clinton is the only person to be blamed for her fate. And I don't disagree. I think that this is a woman who, in the same way that Barack Obama said John McCain had hitched his wagon to the failed policies of George Bush, Hillary Clinton hitched her wagon not just to the failed policies of her husband, but to the failed practices of her husband, meaning the failed approach to campaigning. We can talk about the policies, and I'll go, you know, toe-to-toe with Hillary's biggest supporters on why I do not support her political positions and haven't for many years. But what really gets my goat and where I really think she is going down, why she is going down, is because she bought the Kool-Aid about how to win elections in this country. And it's a Kool-Aid that is breeding or has been instilling a sense of denial in all those who think the way to do it is still the same old way, which is the, what I call in my book, the penthouse party way. What happened during the 8 years of the Clinton presidency? The Democratic Party built up a war chest like you wouldn't believe. But where was that war chest? That war chest was in Washington. How were the resources being used to pay for TV advertising, to pay for high-priced consultants who get money from selling TV advertising, 15% of every sale? They are sitting pretty. Want to talk about the people who are going to be fine after this campaign? The consultants are going to be fine. The penthouse party has a problem. It may have a brand new, beautiful building in Washington, D.C., and that was the great symbol of the departure from Washington of Terry McAuliffe as the head of the DNC and Bill Clinton, two DLC folks. The big symbol of their departure was that they had built this beautiful new office. Well, nice, you have an office. But that DNC office building was the epitome, the symbolic epitome of everything the state parties did not have. In 2000, 2004, we learned the state parties were in a shambles. People were calling into Air America Radio for yard signs. Why? Because there was no office where they lived. The campaigns didn't go to most of the states of the union. And there was nothing worth getting off the website of either of the candidates, of any of the candidates running on the Democratic side for the presidency. We're talking 2004. 2000, we learned they don't even care that much about counting their own voters' votes. And we learned as a people that we had to police the votes ourselves. How dare the Democratic Party walk away from its own voters in Florida as they did? In 2004, what we saw was a party that was in a shambles couldn't win, even when the country wanted to get rid of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney like nobody's business. Who do they rely on to do their electioneering for them while all the money is going to the TV advertisers? They rely on exactly those constituency groups, women and labor and environmentalists and gays and lesbians and immigrants and people of color, black churches, blue-collar unions. Exactly the same interests they diss all year long. How enthusiastic are the blue-collar workers going to be to turn out for the Democratic side of the ticket in a period where the Democrats are polarizing with labor over NAFTA? As Bill Clinton did after coming into office. And Hillary Clinton can say what she likes about what she said in public during that period, in private during that period, but she's on the record in public, and she has a long history of working with exactly that part of the party that was the most heavily and energetically behind the passage of NAFTA, namely the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC. She was part of the creation of it, as was Bill. Her input into Bill Clinton's initial presidential campaign was all about the pre-presidential race tour he took around the country, laying out this kind of third way, not the kind of Democratic Party that's too closely attached or related to or associated with the interests of poor people and people of color and women and minorities and gays and lesbians and you name it. But a Democratic Party that could be as friendly to business, even more friendly than the GOP. Well, that's all very well, but there aren't enough of those business interests to actually get you elected. They can do a whole lot in the kind of pay-to-play system that we have. But when you're up against right-wing that is mobilizing ground troops through churches and gun clubs and Bible study organizations, when you're up against a Republican administration and a GOP that is mobilizing people from the base level up, we often vilify the top-down control structure of the right. Yeah, they do that, but they also build leadership at the base. They also feed the base. They have youth organizations. They have, peer-to-peer organizations. They had a whole network, that 72-hour network to turn voters out in the last few hours before the election. It's all based on volunteers. On the Democratic side, people had to pay, had to be paid. They were paid because there was no party in place. The constituency groups weren't excited enough, and there had been such a long period since anybody actually tried to persuade anybody to become a Democrat. There had been such a long period of hubris, of arrogance. The Democrats are greater in number. Well, they're greater in number, but why are they going to turn out to vote? And how do we know their votes? If we're talking about poor people and young people and immigrants and people of color, these are the people with the most fragile grasp on the right to vote and the ability to have those votes counted. They're the most easily knocked off, meaning the obstacles to them registering are greater than anybody else. Young people face more obstacles to registering to vote because they're voting for the first time. People of color, well, we know about Jim Crow, and it continues to this day. People who move a lot for work are the ones that have to constantly re-register. That's where the traps are, the tripwires are, to being able to cast a vote. And today, when you have a Justice Department under this administration utterly dedicated to suppressing anything that might be a Democratic vote, and don't just take it from me, you can read Scott Orton's excellent piece in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, well, then you just don't stand a chance if you're not putting up a fight. The Democrats didn't put up a fight in all those 8 years in office. Did they reenfranchise felons, generating hundreds of thousands of new disproportionately Democratic voters? No. Did they do any of the smart stuff that would have made it easier for their constituents to vote in the name of protecting the vote? Because it is protecting the vote. The Republicans just pick off the most vulnerable of us. If you stood up for the most vulnerable, you'd be standing up for your base, Democrats. So Hillary Clinton's campaign, yes, she brought a lot of this on herself by doing politics the same old way. What what I believe people on the left side of the spectrum began to realize in 2002, 2004, 2006 was you couldn't wait for the Messiah to come. You had to do it yourself. I write about it in Blue Grit. People got involved in politics who'd never been involved before, and they got involved in all sorts of ways, not just running for office, but recruiting people to run for office, training people, using new technology, acquiring new talents, mobilizing around new issues, making new alliances. And Barack Obama's folks, many of whom came out of the Howard Dean campaign, particularly the New Hampshire campaign that was brilliantly organized by a long-term organizer, some of them with roots in the United Farm Workers of America and Civil Rights Movement, those folks knew that there was something there they could tap into, and they knew how to do it. And they offered people who went to the Barack Obama website, for example, real ways to take leadership and be leaders in their communities. And then they gave them the training to be leaders, not just to vote for Barack Obama, but to do more than that. Hillary Clinton believed you could do a top-down campaign. And if it was all about her qualifications, she would win. Well, it ain't only about her. It isn't only about her qualifications. Americans have had that. They want a campaign that makes them feel they're part of something. That's clearly what Barack Obama's language and positioning and rhetoric and history as an organizer has enabled him to do. Hillary thought money would do it. She front-loaded her campaign, and now she's in trouble. So, I could go on and on about the ways that she made a mistake. She made a political mistake. She made a timing mistake. I think it's a pretty sad story. She's also made mistakes for which there's no excuse, and I count among those the decision to give George W. Bush the authority to go to war. The entire global women's movement knew that women were going to be hurt worst and first by that war, just like any other. And yet the woman now running for president, saying she's so proud to be a woman running for president and complaining so viciously about sexism, voted for that. Media misogyny is bad. War is worse. I would say war is sexist, too. But being a Democrat in America requires a lot of thinking and a lot of wrestling. None of this stuff is simple. I can be angry about the sexism and angry about Hillary Clinton's positions. I can do both those things at once. And in our next segment, we're going to talk to a woman who writes about all of this complexity in a brand new book, Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy, on being an American citizen. Susan Griffin was a Pulitzer Prize finalist with her last book. I think this book's going places, too. You're going to get a sneak peek. It's just about to hit the shelves. Susan Griffin will be our guest after the break. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being there. We'll take your calls. Stay tuned. You're listening to Tom Hartman's show.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Tom Hartman's program here on Air America Radio. If equality is to be achieved, the only remedy is courage. It seems fitting that democracy, which was won with courage, would be sustained by it, too. That's so many pieces of great writing I could quote from the book that we're going to discuss in the rest of this hour, but that's just one. I'm talking about Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy on Being an American Citizen by our guest Susan Griffin. Susan's an award-winning poet, writer, essayist, playwright, filmmaker, the writer of 19 books, including A Chorus of Stones, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. This new book is just exactly where I'm at these days. It is the personal and the political wrestling with each other. It is the internal discourse and the external reality fighting for space on the page. It's a book that I think only Susan Griffin could conceivably have written, a poet and screenwriter, playwright, everything that she is. Because it is a piece of performance even as it is a meditation, and it gets to the heart of what we've been discussing today, which is how damn hard this democracy stuff is. Susan, welcome to the program. So glad to have you with us.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here.
So wrestling. It's a very personal wrestle that you write about in this book.
How did you
come to it?
Well, you know, I think that the seeds of it, I didn't realize that it was that I was going to be writing a book, but I think that the seeds of it began, you know, were sown when in the 2000 election. I was so angered by the fact that the Supreme Court handed the election to George Bush, and despite what, as it turned out, what the vote count even in Florida was. And I felt a very personal rage. It wasn't, you know, of course, my candidate lost, but I was also really furious on a way that seemed to touch at my very core. And over time that evolved into a book that describes how democracy lives at your core and struggles to exist at your core, because I think it's a very long process, really, becoming citizens in a democracy, and we aren't quite there yet.
Now, you were one of those who, years back, I can't remember quite how many years it was now, I think it was 2003 at some point, refused to participate in a symposium, Poetry in the American Voice, hosted by Laura Bush.
Yes.
You've been a member of Code Pink.
Yes,
you are still a member of Code Pink, probably.
I still am.
I wanted to ask, you know, how have you been doing the political work that you do in these times? Where do you feel like you've had a chance to engage with this democracy that you're describing in the book, other than on the page?
Well, you know, I was arrested in 2002, just before the war began, with a group of writers, and I helped to organize the writers and get, you know, sort of my friends out there, and Maxine Hong Kingston, Alice Walker, Terry Tempest Williams. We were all arrested in front of the White House, protesting the war before it began.
And how does that experience compare with the writing experience? Because they're different ways of wrestling, and you write about them beautifully.
They are very, very different. And when I'm in the midst of a book, I can't, you know, sort of be out there demonstrating all the time, although I certainly do go on marches. I went on all the marches against the war, and I show up at picket lines, and I sign things and write letters. But writing is very demanding, and it's a process of discovery. I think you protest out of a sense that you really know what is right, and you're being very true to yourself in the sense that both Thoreau and Gandhi, who was in fact inspired by Thoreau, and Martin Luther King, who was inspired by both of them, felt it and describe it. This sense that of an inner courage that's really grows because you're so deeply aligned with your heart and your soul and your consciousness. But in writing, it's you start with certain assumptions, but you're also exploring, you're discovering. So it's also a willingness to not know.
Mm. We're going to talk more with Susan Griffin, and we'll take your calls on 866-303-2270. We started by talking about actions and writings because that's so much of what is at the heart of this book, that democracy isn't just a concept or a document. It's an action. It's a shift in consciousness. It's a sense of responsibility. It's a responsibility to take actions. We have that responsibility. What actions can we be taking at this moment? And how do we wrestle with our rights and responsibilities in this democracy today? 866-303-2270. We'll be back with more from Susan Griffin after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're back. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Show on Air America Radio. I'm Laura Flanders, and we've been talking about the state of the Democratic political primary race and what is good and what is not about the process that we are going through. Some of the conversation has touched on feelings, that people are feeling just frustrated by this, the way this is all playing out, meaning the good, the silly, and the plain old bad in the exchanges that happen in the name of political debate, as happened last night in the Democrats' 20th debate, silly stuff like the sort of lawless discussion of launching assassination missions in Pakistan and who would be tough enough to do it. I would say rather silly stuff too about just how distanced can one candidate be from Louis Farrakhan. That seemed silly. There's a lot of frustration out there, and a part of the frustration, I think, pertains to the book that we're talking about in this hour. It's Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy on Being an American Citizen by Susan Griffin. The frustration, I think, has to do, and I started the program this way, Susan, by saying, you know, how can a process that to begin gets people so excited and has at its sort of positive side so much participation, so much engagement, then at this point be leaving at least me feeling so kind of ugh? When it becomes focused just on these two individuals and the media trying to get them to score gotcha points off each other and them spending 16 minutes discussing a healthcare plan that isn't even in existence and wouldn't be what we need entirely, there's a sort of frustration. This is our democracy, and you write about it in this book, represented a shift in consciousness. And you write about the Declaration of Independence being not just a document, but an action that expressed and enacted a kind of independence that required a certain level of responsibility and rational thinking and willingness to take action by the citizenry. And yet here we are in an election process where, you know, the actions of the citizens end up getting the least attention occupying the lowest piece of the visibility spectrum in the coverage. You can't even see the people in this process except for the two.
Yes, it's an ongoing kind of wrestling, which we're seeing today. I mean, when Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, I mean, the actual writing of it was the record of an amazing shift in consciousness that he had to go through even to write it. I mean, he writes as if it was the most natural thing in the world for a colony to separate from the empire was from the British Empire. So it was, first place, it was a revolution against an empire, and we should keep that in mind while we're trying to build an American empire. And then, you know, he himself was wrestling, though. He has the most eloquent introduction that we know of the whole concept of equality. And we quote the Declaration of Independence all the time, you know, assume among the powers the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature, by the way, and nature's God entitled us. That was the pretext on which America could separate from Great Britain, because it had an equal right among nations. And then he speaks of the equal rights of who will be American citizens.
And is he right?
Also,
this was such a departure not to root that argument in law or practice, but rather to say this is inherent. It's natural
it's
law.
It's inherent. It's endowed by nature. It's part of natural law, and what he calls nature's God, because he was basically secular. If you look underneath the concept of equality, democracy is based on an equal application of the laws. Everybody, has the same position with regard to the laws, as opposed to an aristocracy or a monarchy where there are people who are privileged under the law. And we also have equality of rights, which means that if I want something, you should want it too. That's what, you know, so that, I'm sorry, if I want something, I can see that you might want it too, that you will want it and you should have it too. So it's a kind of empathetic system at base, but we're at war. Jefferson wanted to abolish slavery, and he kept that position for most of his life, but he did not free his own the people that he held bondage, what they called slaves then, which is a pejorative term, I think. And then he also made an argument that African American people were inferior. Of course, this was a very convenient argument for him, because at one point he held 190 people in bondage, and that's how he kept Monticello going. So even within this one man, there was this wrestling between the basic understanding that something like slavery is abhorrent and a violation of human rights, and his own, you know, not only I think his own convenience economically, but his own tradition as a Southerner and a plantation owner and the way he was raised. And you know, we all still have that vestigial layer of a monarchy in us, and maybe it's a very profound desire to have a parent figure, a godlike figure, a monarch make our decisions for us. And I see that in the election process, where we get silly about the candidates, I think, because we're both electing an official who will do the people's bidding, supposedly, according to the Constitution, but we're also electing a kind of monarchical figure.
And we want a savior.
We want a savior. We want a savior, and that's in the king, and you know, the king in the old, in the monarchical period back in the 16th, 17th, 18th century was supposed to be able to cure scrofula, which was TB. That was the king's ritual, and in France, and the king was a semi-divine figure. That's what the divine right of kings meant. And we want a savior, and I think that's a big mistake. And I think even progressives, and I count myself among progressives, and I think even we make that mistake when we want to elect somebody who's absolutely perfect, because we can't do that. No one single group can elect one person who represents all their points of view, and the candidates make a mistake when they try to sort of make themselves, that's how they get so bland. They try to represent some sort of statistical average. But in fact, once the president is elected, it's really the people who lead. And if you look at American history and you see how democracy has evolved, it's been through people's movements. It's been through the people acting. The abolition of slavery. Yes, Lincoln was a great president. Yes, he enacted the Emancipation Proclamation. He was a principled great president. But there was an abolition movement that went on. You know, for almost a century before.
The same with FDR. People recall the reforms, the changes brought in by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and forget that that wasn't his platform when he got elected. He had to be pushed into that.
That's right. He had to be pushed into that. And Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the people who was the more compassionate in that sort of companionship through which they ran the White House. And she worked with a lot of labor leaders, among them one I write about one of them. Her name was Rose Schneiderman, and she
great chapter you know, on Rose Schneiderman.
She was such a thrilling person, really. You know, came over as a child from a shtetl in Europe, and had suffered pogroms, and came to what was the land of opportunity, and ended up, of course, living in a tenement. Under terrible conditions. Her father died from overwork and those sort of unhealthy conditions, and never even finishing with a high school diploma, and was one of the major organizers of the union movement. And by the way, that's something that we really have to fight for unions and the right of people to strike. Now we constantly have to defend that.
All right, hold it right there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, there's a slew of people that have questions for you about this process. We've got about 5 minutes to cram them all in, but we will do our best. Our guest is Susan Griffin. You'll be able to find her book, Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy, any day on a bookshelf near you, at a bookstore near you. You can already order it online if you're curious. Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy on Being an American Citizen. It's out now from Trumpeter Press. We'll be back with more after the break.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
He's right! That's Tom Hartman. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom while he is cruising the high seas of the Caribbean on the Air America radio cruise ship. We're talking about being an American citizen and wrestling with the angel of democracy with our guest, Susan Griffin. Let me tell you quickly what we've got coming up for you. I'll be with you through Friday, and we're hoping that we're going to have Jonathan Schell on the show tomorrow to talk about the seventh generation of nuclear fears, one of the other big topics that never got into the debate so far, or hardly, certainly disappeared since Dennis Kucinich was kicked off the stage. We also, I think, are going to talk with my uncle and crusading reporter Patrick Coburn on Friday about what the heck is happening in Iraq. He's one of the few people consistently watching what's going on the ground, and he's got a very strong take on all this guff about decreasing violence in that country. Patrick should be with us Friday. Tomorrow we'll also take another look at the decision of that top military overseer of Guantanamo deciding to step down. William Haynes, the Pentagon's chief legal officer, stepped down yesterday. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Here's a quote from Susan's book, one that I think explains why I, at least, try to do radio. She talks about self-knowledge. She says, self-knowledge is a complicated process. It's towards the beginning of the book. What may begin as a flicker of intuition, an image, a strange half-explained desire or discomfort, may evolve into words uttered late at night or early in the morning, spoken in solitude and probably then not even aloud. But without a sympathetic listener, more often than not, such insights evaporate and at least on a conscious level are forgotten. For this reason, and this is the bit I like best, for this reason, one of the most appealing effects of a political movement is that it encourages what is on the edge of consciousness to be spoken and heard when they are still fresh and have not sunk yet into ideologies or truisms. Political movements create a resonant field. and a fruitful one as well, she writes, as observations and insights that have seemed unutterable before are heard, understood, and echoed, new visions come into being. I mean, that is the kind of catalytic world I wish we lived in. I wonder if we do, and I wonder if there's anything in this kind of gotcha fest that poses as the presidential primary debates that is anything about listening or articulating or providing a resonant field. I'll give you a chance to comment on that, Susan. Then there's a lot of people that want to ask you a question. But is there any resonance in this campaign?
Yes, I do. I do feel there is. In the first place, we're looking at both Democratic candidates saying that they want to pull the soldiers out of Iraq. Oh. Now, that is resonant with the people's movement. It was the people's movement that first articulated that position. First place, there were massive marches against us even getting into the war. And then a movement that slowly grew, asking that we get the troops out of Iraq. And now both candidates from the Democratic Party virtually have to say that if they're going to be elected. And so they're resonating with what the people have said.
And that's actually a great example, because the people were saying it when nobody in the media would talk about it.
That's
when
right.
Nobody in politics would stand up and say it to speak of. And they sort of forced that call to be heard.
They forced that. I mean, Code Pink was brilliant at doing things that finally the media had to capture them, because they were so witty and outrageous, you know, dropping a big, huge pink slip from a skyscraper in L.A. as Bush went down the street, you know.
Let's take a couple of calls. Quickly, Dave in Eureka has been waiting, I think, for like 2 hours. Dave, welcome to the program.
1.5 days, I think it was. But I agree with just about everything both of you have to say. I sat through all of these so-called debates, and one observation I would offer is that neither of them can talk about how big corporate insurance, health insurance companies charge as much as they possibly can get away with and pay out as little as they hope they can get away with. And they have
a lot of money left over for campaign contribution.
They do indeed. And I think we see two people sitting there that can't speak a word about getting rid of the insurance companies. So.
All right. Thanks for your call. Let's take another one. Gary in Springfield, Massachusetts, and then we'll get Susan to wrap up. Gary, welcome.
Yes. Good afternoon, Lauren. Susan, I am really intrigued by this discussion. I'll be frank about it. I, like you, Susan, was extraordinarily distressed over this, the 2000 election, in that one man, basically, who was put into place by the would-be president's father for a permanent position in life, would actually end up making the final call on that. And, you know, the people that couldn't see through that are they're putting people into place in power, and I don't think they have any right voting, personally, if you can't see through something like that. But I am perplexed over this election. Part of my gut says Hillary has got the know-how to deal with the process, but I'll tell you the truth, after reading at least part of Barack Obama's book, I've got to say that The Audacity of Hope, that is, he's looking better to me all the time. I think we need that new spirit, that new life in you know, someone who has the drive to take us to the levels that maybe a JFK or someone did in the past.
All right, Gary, thank you. I mean, in those two calls, you get the wrestle. You've got the aspiration, we want the hope, we want the change, and then you've got the reality check. The insurance companies are backing both these people.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's, I think, probably, aside from the war, the most serious problem we have across the boards, and that actually affects the war too, is corporate influence on democracy and really attempt to eat democracy up alive. But I also think it's important that we elect a president who is going to preserve the Constitution, at least in the Bill of Rights, and who's going to listen to people's movements. And that's why I'm supporting Obama, because he is somebody who has worked with people's movements in the past. He has advisors like Samantha Powers, who is concerned about atrocities against civilians, and he's garnered a huge movement of young people who are now entering politics. But we can't leave it at whomever we elect. We can't leave it at that. We have to then, you know, continue to make these changes, and the change against the corporations really is going to have to come from the people, because the people in elected office can't, you know, are beholden to the corporations.
Well, you're absolutely right. The important piece of all of this is that our democracy isn't a once every 4 years or even a once every 2 years thing. It's an everyday kind of thing. It's not easy. It's difficult. It requires us to be active citizens, not just sort of waiting for the Messiah to arrive. It requires us to do the kind of wrestling you're talking about because it's an imperfect science.
That's right.
And one of the things that helps us through are the stories of others who have gone before, and you tell great stories in your book. You profile all sorts of people. I was hoping we'd get a chance for you to talk about Angelina Grimke and some of the others that you write about in the book on the program, but we're out of time. I encourage people to check out Wrestling with the Angel of Democracy. You can get inspiration from the past, and, hey, reminds us that our private personal thoughts outside of the noise machine of the media sometimes can trigger us to have the kind of inspiration that can help others if we remember to share. That what's inside is sometimes as important as our reflections of everything that is outside. I don't put it as well as Susan does, but it's a beautiful memoir and meditation and contribution to our wrestle. Thanks so much, Susan Griffin. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again very soon. I hope everybody, and I'll be back tomorrow sitting in for Tom Hartman. In the meantime, get busy, everyone, and have a little fun while you're at it. I'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned to Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.